and welcome to Rabble Radio. It's Friday, May 27th, 2022. I'm your host, Brianne Doyle. Thanks so much for tuning in. Rabble's got its finger on the beat of the issues that matter to you. If you're curious about the latest news in Canadian politics, labor, environment, or social justice, you've come to the right place to find the stories that matter to you, free of corporate influence. This week on the show, Libby Davies speaks to Medea Benjamin, a co-founder of women-led peace group Code Pink. Code Pink is a grassroots NGO with an anti-war mandate. The goal of Code Pink is to divest from the war machine and from companies that derive their profits from U.S. military interventions, the global arms trade, and the militarization in the streets. Benjamin sits down with Davies to talk about the inception of Code Pink back in 2002 and looking for a non-military solution to end Russia's occupation in Ukraine. Named as a high-profile leader in the peace movement by the Los Angeles Times, Medea Benjamin is the co-founder of Code Pink and co-founder of the human rights group Global Exchange. Benjamin has been an advocate for social justice for more than 40 years, and she is also an author. To date, she has written 10 books, her latest, Inside Iran, The Real History and the Politics of the Islamic Republic of Iran, is part of a campaign to prevent war with Iran and instead promote normal trade and diplomatic relations. Libby Davies is a longtime Vancouver activist, city councillor, and former NDP leader and house leader of the federal NDP, representing the riding of Vancouver East from 1997 to 2015. Davies is also a member of the Order of Canada and author of Outside In, a political memoir. Here are Davies and Benjamin in conversation. Take a listen.
So Medea Benjamin, thank you so much for joining me today. It is wonderful to have this conversation with you. And first off, I want to say, wow, you've just come back from Afghanistan. I can never keep pace with where you are in the world or what you're up to. You're like a human dynamo. You're so busy. So we'll come back to that. But I thought first to begin our conversation, as probably activists and progressives in Canada are possibly not so familiar with the amazing work that you do with Code Pink, tell us a little bit about the origins and the work of the organization.
Well, great to be on with you, Libby. And Code Pink started right after the 9/11 attacks on the US with a group of women who had a premonition that the response to the 9/11 attacks wasn't going to be to seek out those who attacked us and bring them to justice. It was going to be used as an excuse for a lot more violence. And of course, we've seen that over the last 20 years with the US invasion and occupation, not only of Afghanistan, but of Iraq. And as I recall, Libby, you were standing with us in front of the White House in Washington.
I was.
In the cold, where we were protesting every day for months at a time against the war in Iraq. And since then, it's been 20 long years. And Code Pink continues to not only say we don't want our government to be involved in wars of aggression, but we don't want all this money spent on the Pentagon when we have so many unmet needs like a basic healthcare system, or the right for students to go to college without becoming indentured servants for the rest of their lives, or for all the things we need to try to reverse this climate crisis. And so we've been plenty busy for 20 years, Libby, and unfortunately, we still have a lot more to do to try to reverse course and build not only a peaceful foreign policy, but an economy within our country that takes care of needs of the people on the planet and not feeding the war machine.
You guys are everywhere. I see you on social media. And, you know, Kim and I always have a funny story that sometimes when we're going through airports and we're watching, you know, CNN, all of a sudden we see something going on Capitol Hill in Washington, D.C., and there's Medea Benjamin flashing past the screen as she's being arrested or thrown out of some meeting. So I know how active you are, but you're a very grassroots organization, aren't you? You have a lot of activism going on right across the country and even globally.
Well, yes, we have mostly volunteers who have worked with us either for a long time, or we have a new group of young peacemakers who are just getting into this work. And we think that intergenerational work is so important to keep the energy of a peace movement up. And, you know, we haven't been very good at making peace. I wish we had been. And we need more of a movement more than ever today, connecting them to the environmental issues, to the issues of things like the student debt that I mentioned, connecting to issues of the need to put our resources into domestic needs. All of these things are ways for us to connect the issues. And we're doing that around the country, connecting poverty, racism, militarism, and trying to get young people involved.
And you recently came back from Afghanistan. Tell us about that trip and what you did there.
Well, with the war in Ukraine, there's not a lot of eyes on what's happening in Afghanistan. But after 20 years of the U.S. and its allies being involved in bombing people and making people's lives miserable for 20 years, only to then decide to leave and pull the rug out of the economy. We had created an economy that was dependent for 75% of government expenditures on foreign aid. And then suddenly that aid dried up and the U.S. froze the Afghan assets that were in the bank in the U.S. and belonged to the central bank, so that the Central Bank of Afghanistan has no liquidity. It doesn't even have money to give to people who put their funds into the local banks. And there is a tremendous crisis with people having lost their jobs, with no money to pay the government salaries, with the increase of malnutrition, dependence on foreign aid when the aid is drying up. So it's a terrible situation. And then on top of that, you have the Taliban, and they perhaps are not as regressive as they were when they governed in the early 90s, but they have recently banned girls from secondary school from going to get their education. They've recently said that women could not travel on their own without a male guardian. They are certainly not respecting the rights of women and minorities. And so that's an issue that we went to investigate as well.
So were you working with local NGOs around these issues, around the rights of women and the oppression that women are facing?
Yes, we met with all kinds of NGOs, young women's organizations. We visited food distribution centers and orphanages, but we also met with government officials. We met with people in the Ministry of Education and the Central Bank. Our conclusion, Libby, is that while the Western world helped create the crisis in Afghanistan, now doesn't want anything to do with it. And the pledge for humanitarian aid has fell way short of what the UN says is needed. And the money continues to be frozen. And now the international community wants to condition that aid on girls' education. And yet what we came away feeling was that that was a wrongheaded policy. It only made a bad situation worse. And that girls, yes, they need an education, but they also need to eat. And we have to release their money so that the economy can function again. We have to be more generous in the aid. And we have to help women in development projects. We met with a very interesting meeting of the reopening of the Afghan Women's Chamber of Commerce, and met all kinds of women entrepreneurs who are saying, help, you know, people don't have the money anymore to buy our products. And if you really want to help women and girls, give us back our money and help us get this economy moving again. So that's our main conclusion.
And so with your conclusions, do you come back to the US and begin a campaign to lobby in Congress, or how do you move on what you've learned now?
Yes, exactly. We are doing a briefing for members of Congress this week. We're asking for meetings with the top U.S. envoy to Afghanistan and the State Department. We are looking for all kinds of ways to lobby our government to be responsible towards Afghanistan. You know, at one point, Biden admitted to the American public that we were spending $300 million a day on the war in Afghanistan for 20 years, Libby, $300 million a day for 20 years. And then, you know, we don't want to pledge even 2 days worth of that for humanitarian aid. So yes, we need to lobby our government and try to get our priorities straight.
Medea, I know that you've also recently been in Cuba delivering support, especially during COVID. How difficult was that, given the ongoing American embargo?
Well, the Canadian policy towards Cuba has always been a much more rational one than the U.S. one. And we've had 60 years of an embargo on Cuba that was tightened under the Trump administration. And we all thought that when Biden came in, he would revert back to Obama days of opening things up. Instead, he's made things even worse. And Libya, at a time when there is a pandemic, that means that for 2 years, there were virtually no tourists in Cuba, which is a main source of their income. And on top of that, continuing the Trump administration's cutoff of remittances to Cuba from Cuban Americans living here, another main source of income. It has been an extremely difficult time for the Cuban people. And so we know that humanitarian aid we give is just a drop in the bucket, but symbolically it's important coming from the U.S. and particularly from Cuban Americans. We work with a wonderful group called Puentes de Amor, Bridges of Love. And a lot of the money that we raised to bring the shipments of food were raised from the Cuban American community. So we're going to continue to do that. In fact, we have a commitment to send powdered milk to the children's hospitals in all of the provinces. Our next one is going to be in the province of Pinar del Rio. And we plan to keep this up, as well as keep the pressure on the Biden administration to stop this very cruel blockade in the midst of a difficult time for the Cuban population.
And I know, Medea, that you've done the same kind of humanitarian political initiative, for example, in Gaza, in Palestine, in the Middle East. We won't go into that now, but I just know that through Code Pink, you've been in these places that we see in the news where there's just been so much suffering, and you managed to get together and organize people to get over there and have these delegations. So it's quite phenomenal to see. I do want to talk a little bit about the work that you're doing globally with peace activists concerning the invasion of Ukraine by Russia. I know you've been organizing online, you've been connected with the global peace movement, urging for non-military aggression and even nuclear escalation, which of course is a possibility. So the question I have is, what kind of response are you finding to your campaign in North America? Because there's so much propaganda, you know, coming out about the war. So the idea that we need to be promoting peace, a non-military solution, a non-nuclear escalation, is a difficult message to get across right now. So what kind of response are you getting?
It is so difficult to cut through this incredible propaganda machine. And now, Libby, the call is that we have to make sure that Ukraine, quote, wins this war, as if there is any winning in this war. And so as time goes on and this war gets worse and worse, we fear that the pressure is on the Biden administration to become more involved in the war instead of more involved in finding a negotiated solution. And so our job is a very, very difficult one right now. On the positive side, We are hooking up with our friends in Europe and calling for a joint days of action. We have one coming up that we're telling people to get out in the streets and say enough. Our demands are for a ceasefire, negotiated solution, Russian troops out, and no NATO expansion. And we think all of those are key things to call for. We're having an online rally with members of parliament from various countries in Europe, as well as key analysts like Noam Chomsky. And we get inspiration from each other, I think, in these difficult times, when we can reach across to our friends in Canada, our friends in the UK and Germany, inside of Russia, as well as those in Ukraine who want to see an end to this war, and try to make that message something that has more resonance in our own communities.
Well, I was fortunate to attend one of your online rallies that included international activists. And I think it was the one that Jeremy Corbyn was on, and there were people from Belgium and France and elsewhere. It was totally uplifting and inspiring to hear the messages of what's going on in terms of the peace movement in Europe, who are pushing back against NATO expansion and militarization. And I feel that in North America, it's a big job to take on because, as you say, the propaganda is so pervasive. So it's wonderful to hear that Code Pink is taking this on as well, which leads me in a way to my next question. You know, the work that you and Code Pink do for peace, it's really hard and challenging, both politically and no doubt personally. So what keeps you motivated, Medea, to keep going?
Oh, I think I'm so privileged to be able to travel and meet with people who are in such much more desperate situations, and to be inspired by them. Just coming back from Afghanistan, for example, we held a press conference, and there were a group of women at that press conference, women reporters, and they challenged the Taliban directly at that press conference, saying, how can you trust them when they go back on their word on all kinds of things? And there were Taliban sitting in the audience right there. And I went up to the woman afterwards, and we've since been in touch, and she keeps sending me videos that she is doing from around the country of women challenging the Taliban. And I think, you know, what courage that takes. And so I see that all over the world. And, you know, they get inspired by meeting us, and we get inspired by meeting them. And I think that kind of interaction is what keeps me going.
And how do you find the political response? Are there people in the political movement who are elected, either Congress people or even internationally, who give you a sense of optimism that in the, you know, the so-called halls of power, there are people who are willing to listen, who are willing to champion and go against this, you know, propaganda of war and militarization?
Well, I must say that you were one of our inspirations, and you are one of our inspirations. The fact that you came out and stood with us in front of the White House, being an elected official, was so meaningful for us. And the fact that people like Jeremy Corbyn are on the board of the Stop the War Coalition in the UK is also an inspiration. And yes, we have our own Congress people here, like Ilhan Omar and like the head of the Progressive Caucus here, Pramila Jayapal, who are terrific. And it is so important that we have that kind of inside-outside strategy, that we have those people on the inside. This Saturday's online rally, we're going to have Claire Daly from Ireland, who is just a wonderful example of a person elected at the European Parliament who gave a speech about Ukraine, saying, what about Afghanistan? And she was so fiery that that went viral. So yes, we need the people on the inside who've got the moral courage like you, Libby, to stand up to our governments and to give us a voice on the inside.
I've been exploring issues of gender and women-led leadership. And it made me think, Medea, in all the years I've known you, we've always talked about issues, you know, whenever we've communicated here and there by email, or we've been at something together, or when you were trying to get across the Canadian border and they kept trying to turf you out, and we'd have to go down to the border and try and get you across. But I've never talked to you about what it's like to lead as a woman. So what is your experience being like leading an organization that's very diverse, it's very broad, and you've sustained it for 20 years?
Well, I must say that I love working with women. It is so much easier to have a collaborative atmosphere, to work collectively, to try to tone down people's egos, including my own. It is really a wonderful thing. And I know when I'm in spaces now where there are a lot of men, I always run back to my sisters to say, this is where I feel more comfortable, more secure. And I think that we have power because we do work collectively. And I've done that now with Code Pink for over 20 years. And people, you know, when you ask things like, how do you keep going? I think it's because of that community of women that we understand how wrong the societies are that mostly men have built over these years. And that as women, I think we also are perhaps better at having the vision of the kind of society that we want to live in, and gives us a lot of energy to keep moving forward.
Well, Medea, I want to thank you so much for sharing a little bit of time with us today, because I know how busy you are. And to say that you are totally a model for how activism should be done, when you talk about the inside, the outside, building alliances, working internationally, working locally, working in a collective way. This is all just, you know, absolutely the way it has to happen. So thank you so much for joining us. I don't know where you're going to be next, but wherever it is, I wish you well. And I'll certainly be following along what Code Pink is up to and participating in whatever ways I can.
Well, thank you so much. You've been a great inspiration and a wonderful friend for many years now, and I look forward to more. Thank you, Libby.
Was a conversation between Medea Benjamin, co-founder of peace group Code Pink, and Libby Davies. If you'd like to get involved with Code Pink's anti-war efforts, visit codepink.org/peacemaker to learn more. Now it's time for a segment we call In Case You Missed It. And for that, I'll hand it over to the editor of Rabble.ca, Nick Seabrook. Over to you, Nick.
Thanks, Brianne. This week, Rabble shared an op-ed piece by Indigenous lawyer and Ontario provincial election candidate Naomi Sayers. Sayers details the harassment she has received from men since announcing her decision to run as an independent in her riding of Sault Ste. Marie. Sayers writes, "My political campaign is not a Tinder profile. I'm not looking to date, especially not as a result of my political campaign. I'm looking at prioritizing voters, their concerns, their lives, and the issues that matter to them." She went on to explain how threats and sexual violence are just some of the barriers that women who want to enter politics have to face. A poll conducted this week by SueToday.com found that Sayers is leading the race in her riding against five other candidates. The informal online poll saw Sayers 3 points ahead of the progressive conservative candidate. Also this week, Rabble's new labor reporter Gabby Kaluge-Kasuga published her first story on the ongoing negotiations between the Public Service Alliance of Canada and their employer. The union, better known as PSAC, filed for conciliation last Wednesday after declaring that the negotiations had reached an impasse. PSAC National President Chris Aylward filed the motion for conciliation after what he says was an insulting offer from the federal government's negotiator. The federal government offered a wage increase of just 1.75% for PSAC employees, well below the current rate of inflation, which approaches 7%, and even well below PSAC's ask of 4.5%. Aylward asserts that the government also did not address other PSAC demands, which include anti-racism and anti-discrimination training in all federal workplaces. Now that a motion for conciliation has been requested, it is expected that both parties will present their arguments to a public interest commission. This week also saw the beginning of Rabble's coverage of the 2022 Colombian presidential election. Rabble.ca is participating in a delegation sent to observe the May 29th election. The delegation is being organized by Common Frontiers, the Colombian Working Group, and the Canada-Colombia Solidarity Committee. Jace Tanner and Raul Burbano will be reporting on Rabble's behalf on the ground in Colombia. The first story filed by Burbano that was published over the weekend details how American activist and election observer Terry Matson was denied entry to Colombia on May 22nd. The official reason given for her denial of entry was that she represented a risk to the state. Matson is the Latin American coordinator for Code Pink. In recent years, she has observed elections in five different Latin American countries. Finally this week, Rabble also shared a letter signed by 26 economists warning the public and the Bank of Canada against drastically raising interest rates. The use of monetary policy to fight inflation roughly corresponds to a transfer of funds from the pockets of households to the vaults of banks and the pockets of their shareholders, the letter reads. The economists go on to argue this solution entails a class bias. An aggressive intervention by the Bank of Canada would place the burden of the fight against inflation on the shoulders of the most vulnerable people. Those who are affected by an increase in interest payments are families who will renew or take out a mortgage, young people with student debt, and small business owners. You can catch all of those stories and much, much more on Rabble.ca.
Thanks, Nick. We'd also like to share with you listeners the return of the Courage My Friends podcast. That's right. Back by popular demand, the Courage My Friends podcast is back for a second season and will be hosted on Rabble's podcast network as part of Needs No Introduction. Presented by the Tommy Douglas Institute and Rabble.ca with the support of the Douglas Coldwell Layton Foundation, Courage My Friends will share a new episode every Monday for the next 6 weeks, beginning May 30th. In the words of the great Tommy Douglas, "Courage My Friends, 'tis not too late to build a better world." The last thing we'd like to leave you with, listeners, is this. Our next Off the Hill panel is right around the corner. On Tuesday, June 7th at 7:30 p.m. Eastern Standard Time, join us for Off the Hill, Hot Summer in the West. With the departure of the current disgraced premier and the increasingly vitriolic conservative leadership race federally, what can we expect to see happen in Alberta and Ottawa? And what will be the impact on the political scene overall? Register for this free event with the link in our description, or for all of you listening on radio, visit rabble.ca to learn more. And that's it for Rabble Radio this week. Thanks as always for tuning in. If you like the show, please consider subscribing to our show on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts. And please rate, review, share Rabble Radio with your friends. It takes 2 seconds to support independent media like Rabble. If you have feedback for the show, ideas, stories, opinions you'd like us to cover, we'd love to hear about it. Get in touch with us anytime at editor@rabble.ca. Thank you to Carl Nirenberg for supplying the music today, and thank you to all the journalists and writers who contributed to this week's content on Rabble.ca. And lastly, thank you to you for tuning in to Rabble Radio. Shout out to the listeners at CJLY FM Kootenai Co-op Radio in British Columbia this week. I'm Brianne Doyle, and I'll talk to you next week.